Good morning. Today we're going to do the last half of the second chapter, complete what I've been calling the anteroom, via the topic of volition, or free will. And after this we'll have established that we are given something automatically, which is reliable, that's the data of the senses, and that beyond that point, the functioning of consciousness is not automatic. It's volitional and requires guidance. And that's what will take us into the conceptual level. Now, a few points by way of overview of this section on volition. At first, it discusses the primary choice, which is really the core of the issue. Choice to focus or not. That's followed by an answer to how do you reconcile volition and causality. And I go there to some length on why there's no problem in such reconciliation. And only then at the end, when we have finally laid out what is volition, what is that choice to think consist of, do we then discuss the validation of volition in a brief sequence at the end. Now, a few points before we turn it over to questions. This is going to be, I hope, primarily questions today, but I'm going to make just a few points in advance. On page 83, on the second paragraph, in other words, the first full paragraph, that this is the first that I know of as a formal definition in print of focus. And this is my own, but I understand that this is the essence of the concept. That's the second sentence there. The state of a goal-directed mind committed to attaining full awareness of reality. Or I put it more informally in the preceding sentence, it's purposeful alertness, but those terms have to be clarified. Purposeful or goal-directed. If you want, you can think of that as the genus of focus, because there are many other types of goal-directed state of awareness. For instance, evasion is goal-directed. You have a definite purpose there. You're not just letting your mind drift. You're summoning your energies up to do something, only it's the exact opposite of focus. So in this sense, goal-directed is broader than focus. It names the basic, it's a consciousness that is being run by its owner, taken over to do something. That's the root of focus, that's the genus. And now what distinguishes focus from other goal-directed states? In focus, you're not necessarily thinking, that's why I say committed to it. I don't say a goal-directed mind engaged in attaining full awareness, because that would imply that focus itself is a process of acquiring knowledge. That is not true. It's the precondition. And so we describe it as a mental set, a readiness, a placing of your mind in the position where, as and when reality requires it, you will start to think. A position of primary receptivity to what's out there. Attunement, readiness. And therefore, I try to pack all that into the word committed. A goal-directed mind committed around the premise of attaining full awareness of reality. And then, of course, the expression of that as and when some facts require thought is you go smoothly from your basic state of focus into a state of thought and then back out again when you're finished thinking. And you just stay there with the motor idling, so to speak, until and unless you decide for whatever reason to go to sleep or just let it go, give up purpose and drift, which under certain circumstances is okay, as long as you're not coming to conclusions, getting married or choosing a career, etc., taking action on the basis of that mental set. Now, elaborating that definition, how do we decide what constitutes full awareness of reality here? When is a mind attempting to attain or committed to attaining full awareness? And the text does present it, but I just want to stress that full awareness does not have anything to do with awareness of everything. It does not mean omniscience. Full awareness really consists of two points, which I state in the next paragraph. Awareness of all the facts which you know to be relevant, and awareness of them as clearly, as sharply, as distinctly, as precisely as possible, as against an impression, an approximation, as sort of, I kinda know, as against that. Now, how do you judge whether somebody is trying to attain all the facts as clearly as possible? Ultimately, you can only judge by what kinds of mental processes he uses when he does think. That is, he doesn't have to use them in the state of focus, he simply has to be committed to them as and when they're necessary. But if, when the time comes to think, he just sits there and gazes, he doesn't try to integrate, he doesn't remind himself of his definitions when that's relevant, he doesn't try to clarify the distinction between one concept and another when he feels that they're overlapping, he doesn't check his logic. In other words, he just goes on doing something or other, but he doesn't make deliberate use of the mental processes and methods that he knows are required to reach the truth. Then he is not in focus. Now, obviously, this depends on what he knows. And the mental processes that a less trained person will use will be not nearly as sophisticated as those of a more highly trained person. So you can have the state that a person is performing to the best of his ability and he is in focus, even though he's not performing as well as someone who is semi-out of focus and has many more cognitive skills. It has to be judged focus within the context of what is available to the individual. And that is why a child can very well be in full focus, even though the mental processes that he engages in to come to a conclusion are extremely simplified, omit all kinds of facts that he simply doesn't know is relevant, perhaps has all kinds of confusions that he has no way of grasping that he's got. And if his exact mental process were translated into an adult mind, that would be, you know, drunkenness, perhaps. That would be out of focus in spades. But in the child, it's in focus. So focus is a description of the psychological state. The primary turning the switch on is the same for everybody. The commitment, the readiness. But when you actually start to cash that in and perceive, go after full awareness in a thought process, then you have to judge whether the person is still in focus according to the information available to him about thinking methods, what he knows about the subject, etc. I say that because I don't want you to think that you can simply go around and say, well, if a person is inducing, deducing, giving definitions, integrating, he's in focus. You can't do it that way. It's the utilizing the full resources of your mind within the limits of your knowledge in your context. Now, the essence of focus in that preliminary sense, to use a bad word, but I want to use it deliberately to try to underscore this, is the opposite of relaxation. It's tension, the thing that everybody wants to get away from. You know, we have a culture in which you could make a fortune on relaxation seminars, and of course you couldn't get a nickel for a seminar on how to become more tense. But tense and intense are related. And, of course, you can use these terms, and they often are used in ways that make tension bad and relaxation good, if tension has to do with anxiety and doubt and conflict and so on. But in the sense we mean it, there is a very good thing about tension that there is a cultural bias against, and that is the tautness, a I use that word, the tautness of purpose, of being goal-directed, of ruthlessly stripping aside the irrelevant, having a direction, having something you want to do with your mind, and then going after it. Pulling in the reins and not sprawling is the equivalent of holding your stomach in if it's sagging, a mental girdle that pulls it together and focuses your alertness. Now that is work. You cannot do it by just letting go, letting your mind spread, taking a Valium and feeling, you know, easy and relaxed. And in that sense, focus should be assimilated to the side of tension, tautness. It is the opposite of relaxation, spread, and so on. Now, I give some discussion in the book, so I don't want to elaborate that. Let's go over to page 88. These five-minute comments are taking on a life of their own. I want to just point out to you, because some people, me included in the old days, have trouble with the idea of an irreducible choice. Now, according to objectivism, the choice to focus is irreducible. Not every choice, of course, is irreducible. Not every choice is primary, but the choice to focus is irreducible. Of course, it's not caused by parents or teachers or heredity or environment, you know that. But more than that, it is not caused by any content of your consciousness either. And this is a point that I want to stress. It's not that you have certain ideas, and therefore you say, okay, given my conclusions, I'm going to focus. It's not that you have certain goals or values, and you say, all right, because I want to achieve my goals, make a living, make love, whatever, I'm going to be in focus today. The primary choice has to be irreducible. It can't be derivative from anything prior, even from your own mental content. Now, that it should be obvious that you can't have mental content until your consciousness is first operative. And you can't be guided by your mental content till you're there. And in that sense, the state of focus is the state of bringing you into existence as a conscious being. And it's that only that can enable you to make use of, or apply, or derive anything from the mental content you already have. This, therefore, has to precede any mental content, the operation of any mental content. That's true in your very first act of focus, and that's true till the day you die. So you cannot ask why. You can say, you have the capacity and you chose to exercise it. That's what's meant by saying the choice is irreducible. Now, I say that out loud on page 88. There is no such why, only that you chose. Now, I had trouble with that for years. It's one of those things, like, where did the universe come from? Although I never had trouble with that. Because in Canada, we knew, you know, where it came from. But there's a lot of things in philosophy that I did have trouble with. And there was a certain point at which I just had to say, well, to hell with it. I know it now intellectually, you know, in spades. And this nagging desire to say where from or why or whatever is just a carryover from the old context. And you can get to suppress it. And finally, you get exasperated with people who keep asking it. Although I'm honest enough to remember when I did. In any event, I'll just recount for you briefly one excerpt of a conversation I had with Ayn Rand. I used to constantly ask her to this effect. I can't imagine an unmotivated action. I just can't imagine how you could do something without being able to say, because I wanted to achieve such and such. And among many other things that she told me, she said to me, well, what do you mean by motivation? I said, well, pursuing some object. And she said, well, before you are conscious, how can you know about pursuing an object? Nothing is before your mind. There is no object. You're not in contact with anything yet. How can you select this is what I'm after rather than that before the world is present to you? Now, finally, you know, after years, hundreds of conversations from many different angles, I came to grasp that it is primary. But you have to come to see that. Another point you may find helpful that Ms. Rand made to me, she said it is not true that conscious beings always exercise their capacities in order to achieve a goal. She said you must not oversimplify the idea and make as a dogma that every single action that every person does is always motivated by some goal in the future that he's after. She said, for instance, it's very common in developing beings, children, babies, and so on, that they will exercise their capacities simply because they have the capacity and because of the pleasure that comes from exercising, actualizing a potential that they have. A child will get on a bicycle and take delight in its ability to drive. And if you say, what's your goal? You see this as a means of transportation. You want to get to school. You want to go somewhere. Are you trying to lose weight? You say, I have no goal. I just like doing it. He's got the ability. He likes to. He has a capacity, and he gets pleasure in the sheer actualizing of that capacity. I found that helpful when she pointed that out to me, because I had this, you know, just as a kind of a rationalistic dogma. All actions are motivated, and then focus is an action, therefore, and I couldn't break the hold of that. And she said, you have to look at the facts of reality. I just saw that the other day. My daughter was on the jungle gym, and she said, look, Daddy, and she held herself upside down with her legs. Now, if you were on the premise, you know, what is she trying to, what is her goal, you know? There is no goal. That was it. She could do it, so she wanted to do it, and that's it. Now, this is applicable to the basic capacity of focus, even as adults. You don't become conscious in order. First you become conscious. And simply because that's inherent in your being a living being. Your contact with reality does not require that you give yourself a reason for it. That's the precondition of having any reasons for anything. That's the precondition of you being around. You exercise that simply as a being whose existence depends upon his awareness. And therefore, at any moment, if you're not sleeping, you come to. But it's not that you do it as a means to a specific goal. Now, the best, I'm trying to stress from different ways the sense in which the choice to focus is irreducible. You cannot get beneath it. And I think maybe the simplest example, the paradigm for coming into focus, is when you're asleep in the morning, you wake up, there is a split second, some people it's even more than a split second, where you are not in focus, you're not awake, and you're not asleep. You're awake enough to know that you're coming to, but you haven't yet come to. There's a split second there where if someone started to ask you a question, you would have to do something to pull the reins tight and say, oh yeah, here I am, okay. Now, that is for me, the paradigm of what coming into focus is. It's that pulling the switch, pulling the reins. It's exerting your faculties, gathering yourself together, in effect, looking around and saying, I'm here. And if I were to say to you in the morning, in that split second, before you complete the process, what's your purpose? Why are you doing this? First of all, you could not even grasp my question until you came to. And then, as soon as you grasped it, you would say, well, I don't have any purposes yet. I'm still asleep. And the moment you come to, you say, oh, well, now I can think about breakfast or philosophy or whatever it happens to be. Or if I were to say to you in that split second, what idea of yours are you thinking about that is influencing you at this moment to make you wake up? You would have to say, honestly, I'm not thinking yet. No ideas are working. Nothing is operative. I'm not conscious yet. Now that is the sense in which we mean a primary choice. Until you've made that choice to focus, which of course has to be remade continuously. It's not just when you come to, but it's most dramatic there first thing in the morning. Until you make that choice, your mind is not in position to function. It can't make any other choices, decisions, pursue any cognition, etc. That is the base. And that is what we say is not motivated. It's not subject to higher level considerations like conclusions, motives, goals. Now, beyond that point, everything has a reason, a specific cause lying within your knowledge, your values, etc. But that basic choice is irreducible. Now, that's about all I can say on that point. There are going to be some people who get that, and others who go to their grave unhappy about that because they have in their mind the idea that causality requires an antecedent cause for everything. So no matter what you say, they say, and what caused that, and they want an infinite regress. If you hold that, then you have rejected the idea of an irreducible principle, an irreducible choice. And if you have, nobody can do anything with you. In that way, it is like the idea of existence being a primary. There are people who balk at the idea of existence being a primary, and they have to have something before. And the same is true here. The choice is a primary. You just can't get anything before. Now, then, thereafter, I discussed the three essential states, which is our primary choice. To focus, being out of focus, just simply drifting, that state of, quote, mental relaxation. And then the positive aberration, which is evasion. Not all non-focus is evasive. There's like three states. Turning the motor on, just turning it off and letting it idle, or turning it in reverse and going backwards, in effect. And evasion is the deliberate refusal to focus on a content. I have passages in there discussing those, so I won't elaborate that further. Now, that's the sum of the first sequence. Now, then, the issue of causality in the second sequence. And, of course, the objectivist view is that above the choice to focus, every choice we make is free and caused simultaneously. And that there is no conflict whatever about that. And here the key point is on 95. And this is pretty much verbatim from something Ayn Rand told me, the second last paragraph on 95. I mean, it's verbatim as much as I could remember her exact words 10 or 15 years later, but the principle of causality does not apply to consciousness in the same way that it applies to matter. That she said in so many words. In regard to matter, there is no issue of choice. To be caused is to be necessitated. There's no options, no alternatives, there's no faculty of even presenting alternatives or of being aware of different possibilities. There's simply the thing reacts unavoidably given its nature and the circumstances. But in regard to the higher level actions, that is the things above focus, to be caused does not mean to be necessitated. And she stressed that. I remember that was a big revelation to me. Because the point was, to be caused is simply that some cause is operative to explain what happened. But the key here is that man chooses the causes, on 96 now, man chooses the causes that shape his actions. So there are causes, but those causes are a result of the way we use our consciousness. If we make a certain choice to focus, as I give examples here, both in thought and in action, then a certain type of causal factor will start to operate. And that will govern the course of our thought or our action. You can always say, why? Why did you think this way? Well, because this was the information. Why did you put it together this way? Well, this is my understanding of logic. Why did you pursue this subject? Because this is my goal. and this is my value. There'll always be many whys that you can explain what you're thinking about, why you took the steps you did, why you made the errors you did. You do not say about all of that, I chose. But all of those whys will come down to one way or the other. They will ultimately come back to you kept the contact with reality or you let it go. You summon the full resources of your mind to be aware of everything relevant in thought or action, or you didn't. In other words, you chose to focus or not. And in that sense, all these higher level choices are caused, but they are still free because the source of their causes is the irreducible choice to focus. I just don't know how to make that clear, although I see some people, maybe you're just frowning in appreciation. Now, when I say that all higher level choices reduce to the primary choice, I know from years of experience that there are going to be people who misinterpret that. Everything in philosophy is subject to misinterpretation. I guess everything is. But when I say all higher level choices reduce to the primary choice, let me ask you, is that the same as saying we really only have one choice, to focus or not? And that once we make that choice, everything thereafter happens automatically. Is that the same thing? It is not. And if you think it is, you're completely confused. I say that because I once thought that. I've thought everything wrong at some point. The primary choice is the root, but it is not the only choice. You mustn't think that all higher level choices are determined by the primary choice. It's not as though every other choice follows routinely, effortlessly, automatically from that. This is the actual pattern. The choice to focus is the start. Then, if you are in focus, you go on to make countless further choices. Now, those further choices, like to put your mind in this direction rather than in that, or to put your body in this direction rather than that, are real choices that are made for a reason. That's the whole point. They are real choices made for a reason. The fact that there's a reason doesn't mean they're not real. The fact that they're real doesn't mean that they're primary. The choice to focus is a primary, but the higher level choices are still real choices that you have to exert will to make. And of course, the reason, if you are in focus, the reason for your choices are the various factors that you are aware of that are relevant to whatever it is, cognition, action, etc. The best way to put this is, I think, is the way I have a 98, that middle little sentence, such as the choice, that is the choice to focus, which controls all of one's subsequent choices and actions. You could use the word controls, conditions, or governs, but not which necessitates. That key point is there that the choice to focus does not necessitate all your subsequent choices. Otherwise, a necessitated choice would be a self-contradiction. It would be something you're choosing, but which you nevertheless had no choice about. It was necessitated. So, the trick here is to grasp the concept of a choice which is controlled by a basic choice, but which is nevertheless a real choice. And if you grasp that, there's no problem. But some objectivists have the idea that your only choice is to focus, and thereafter we're zombies. In effect, you just turn the x-ray machine on or turn the car motor on, and then you just walk around, and thereafter you stare, so to speak. You never exert any further will, but just that inner, you know, summoning up. And then you just wait for reality to act on you. Everything else then is determined given that you're in focus. That is not correct, obviously. If you observe yourself in real life, you have to make continuous acts of will once you're in focus, even granted you're fully in focus. Now, for instance, try this experiment. You want to raise your right arm. Now, do the following. You're fully in focus, right? I mean, you hear what I'm saying, you're attentive. Now, I want you to focus fully The reason why, as an experiment, it's desirable to raise your arm, your right arm. Are you doing that? Now, you want to cooperate with the experiment, right? You have nothing against it, so your whole reason, but nobody's raising their arm. Even though you are, but I don't know. I'm just in the middle here. But the reason that you're not is that even given those reasons, you have to decide to make them operative. There's a reason why you're doing it. I mean, it's not as though suddenly the whole class raised its arm, you know, causelessly or by a primary choice. There is a reason, but it is still a choice. And until you say, okay, I'm going to execute that reason, I'm going to make it work, your arm won't raise. Now go back again into that state, count to three, and at that moment, exert the act of will required to bring it into reality. One, two, three. All right, now that is a choice. Now that is a real choice. It wasn't necessitated by your being in focus, but it had a cause. And the cause was, of course, I gave you the reason why. You wouldn't have done it if you weren't in focus. You wouldn't even have heard what I was saying. But being in focus was simply the conditioning factor, the precondition of your consciousness functioning. You nevertheless, after that, had to engage in an act of will. And in that sense, you cannot get away from continuous willing at every moment that you're awake. So you can go wrong many ways here, but what I'm trying to separate for you is the basic choice, which is irreducible, the higher level choices, which are real, but not irreducible, although when you reduce them to the primary choice, that doesn't mean you obliterate. You got that? Now that is the benefit of decades of antagonizing Ayn Rand to the point where she couldn't talk about this issue anymore. She was just fed up that I still was confused. But I finally got that put together in my mind this way, and I see that. I mean, to me, that's perfectly clear. So that is the thing to try to clarify if you don't get it. But you see, it's as simple as raising your arm if you actually focus on it. That's the most I can do for this nest of problems that torture people. And I know they do, and I sympathize. Just walk around raising your arm and try to catch what happened. The other thing is, this is an impossible assignment, but try to catch yourself in the moment before you wake up. And then watch yourself coming to. Of course, that's a self-contradiction because you have to be in focus to direct yourself. That's the whole point. Until you're in focus, you can't make use of your faculties. But if you can maybe give yourself the order before you go to sleep and peek as you're coming to. It's very hard to catch yourself out of focus. I mean, because once you are, you're not looking anymore. Now, there's so much for causality. Of course, that's not going to satisfy a determinist, but I'm not trying to satisfy a determinist, just a person. Now, the last sequence. So far, of course, we've offered no proof, no validation. I've just described focus. I've stated the relation between the choice to focus and other choices. I've said that it's not inconsistent with causality, but I haven't done anything but describe. I haven't validated. And of course, every philosophic principle has to be validated. So what is the validation? And of course, the answer is that volition is an axiom. It's a self-evident axiom. There is no proof. It's the precondition of all proof. The difficulty with volition is not establishing that it is, but in grasping what it is. So it's the paradox that you need 20 pages to say what it is, and once you're able to distinguish it, it's so hard to talk about states of consciousness because they're so evanescent that we have no real vocabulary worked out to describe them. But once you spend 20 pages saying what it is, you say, and it's self-evident that it is, once you know what we're talking about. And in this sense, the whole of the present chapter of the anteroom is axioms which are corollaries of the basic axiom, specifically corollaries of the axiom of consciousness. The senses, as we saw last time, the validity of the senses is just an expression of the axiom of consciousness. And now today we're saying volition is merely an expression of the axiom of consciousness. Does that mean that volition applies to any conscious being? No. Volition is a corollary of what kind of consciousness? A conceptual, or putting it at the same point another way, a fallible consciousness. If you had a completely determined, infallible being, like an animal or an angel, assuming such existed, they could not go wrong. Then theoretically, their consciousness could be completely determined with no choice of any kind. So volition, I've covered that in the text, volition is not inherent in consciousness as such. But if you have a fallible consciousness, a consciousness which is not built so that it automatically corresponds to reality, then either it itself is in control of its operation. It itself chooses to conform to reality, or else the whole faculty is invalidated. If it's not automatically in conformity to reality, and on top of that you have no power to choose that course, you have no clue what it's doing, whether it's reliable, and that means your consciousness is not conscious, which is a contradiction. And in that sense, volition is a corollary, in the context of a human being, of the axiom of consciousness. We've already said in another question period, so I won't repeat here, it's accessible to direct awareness. You could catch it 1,000 times a day by just watching when you raised your arm. That act of will is something you will. And no number of tomes by a determinist is going to talk that out of existence. That is a distinct reality, that experience of moving your arm, that will, that now I'm doing it, that choice. And no matter how much you know about anatomy, physiology, psychology, nothing is going to erase that reality, that act of choice. That's what the essence of free will consists of. Now notice, for those of you who are eager for polemics, that it is true that determinism is self-refuting, as presented in the chapter, but that is not the proof of free will. It is not the validation of free will to show that even a determinist has to accept it. That is nothing unique to free will in that point. All axioms are inescapable. All axioms are such that their enemies have to use them to reject them. That's inherent in the fact that they are axioms. They're at the foundation, and therefore no one can open his mouth without them. But I remember Ms. Rand saying clearly that she does not believe in any type of self-refuting type argument to validate a truth. That is, she rejects as a methodology the idea you can prove proposition A by showing that non-A is impossible and refutes itself. And her formulation, I believe, is something on this order. A truth has to be accessible to man from the facts. There can't be a truth that you get only by finding out what's wrong with its enemies. And those people who are, you know, gung-ho to show that determinism is self-refuting, that's okay, I mean, you know, just to get them off your back, the determinist, but that is not the validation. That is simply an aspect of what it is to be an axiom. Inherent in being an axiom is it's inescapable. But another thing inherent in being an axiom is that it's fundamental to all cognition. That's why it's inescapable. And another thing to being an axiom is that it'd be a primary. That's where you start, because it's given you by direct awareness. In this case, of course, by introspection, not by extrospection. And now just one last little point on the one element of the distinctiveness. Of course, this whole concept of focus is absolutely distinctive to Ayn Rand. I've never heard a theorist of volition in history approach it this way. So the whole thing is a completely original theory. But specifically, I do want to point out the radical opposition to Kant, which I mentioned on 107 and 108, and which is essential to grasping the objectivist perspective. One of Kant's worst, most vicious statements was his lumping together of mysticism with volition in his statement, God, freedom, and immortality. That's a Kantian phrase. Freedom there doesn't mean political freedom. It means free will. And for Kant, these three stand and fall together. He had an incredible argument. He said, we couldn't prove any one of these three by reference to this world. Because in this world, you see, causality held sway, and for him that was incompatible with free will. But he said, from the fact of morality, that we should do certain things, we can infer we must have the freedom to do them, and must therefore be freedom in another world, because in this world we have no freedom. And by the same token, we should be rewarded for doing what's right, but in this world, you know, the good suffer, so there must be another world where you go. So immortality came in, mind you, in the same argument that proved free will. And of course, there has to be somebody in the other world to say, well done, here's your reward, or shame on you, off to hell. And that's God. So all three came in by the same supernatural argument. Well, you can simply imagine the historical effect of that. That was the final discrediting of volition. The final statement that volition just reeks of the supernatural, of mysticism, that anybody who wants to be rational or scientific has to throw it out. And as I put it, I think this is a good sarcastic paraphrase of Kant. He gave us the banner of ghosts, choice, and the pearly gates. You know, God, freedom, and immortality. God is a ghost, immortality, you go to the pearly gates, and choice is stuck in there. Now, of course, if people accept this as an approach, they're going to have an absolute dichotomy between reason and choice, or reason and will. Will will convey something demoniacal, mystical, otherworldly, supernatural. Reason will be related to science, logic, and this world. And of course, that was exactly what happened in the history of philosophy. After Kant came a whole string of voluntarists. And that means those who elevated the will, which, of course, to them had nothing to do with reason. They made will the primary factor, and man was just this diabolical process of irrational willing. And thus Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and so on. Now, the key point in Ayn Rand is that she refuses to oppose reason and will. In fact, will is not even something over and above reason. And here the key sentence is the first sentence on 108. The faculty of reason is the faculty of volition. Because we don't have 10 faculties in there. It's not as though we have a capacity to think. Oh, and besides that, there's another capacity next door to will. And that one steps in and tells the mind to will. And there isn't a whole set of these things. It's just the conceptual faculty. And it happens to be volitional. As it exercises itself, as you exercise it, you are at the same moment, if you're engaged in a thought process, reasoning and choosing. Every step of your reasoning is a step of choosing, willing, selecting this alternative or that one, this way or that, pause on this or not, add in that factor or not. You can't engage in reasoning without continuous willing. So there are two different concepts. One names the overall faculty of knowledge. The other identifies the aspect that it is volitional, that a process of will is required. But you can think that reason and will are related like existence and identity. It's two different concepts to stand for one indivisible entity. We're just naming will is simply the name we give to the same faculty of reason when we think of it as being manifest in continuous volitional choices. but that is not a separate faculty. It's not a mystical add-on. It doesn't pertain to the soul as against the body, etc., etc. If you know the history of philosophy, you will know that that is itself a very revolutionary process. The assimilation of will to reason is one of Ayn Rand's unique contributions here. All right, that's my 10-minute overview. But I'll get back later in the course by saying nothing when you expect me to say something. All right, now let's start from... I had a written question. I'm not supposed to, but I did it anyway. But this is brief. When and by what means does a child become aware of his consciousness and volition, i.e. know that the axioms of consciousness and volition are true? It must be long after his first perception. Well, first of all, consciousness and volition in this sense don't come to be known at the same time. Even though volition is ultimately a corollary, you learn them at different points. Consciousness, as I said, you learn, I can't give you a date, but certainly much later than your first perception, perhaps months after. First you grasp your first sensation. Then you have to reach the stage of integrating to entities. And then you have to perceive entities. Then you have to grasp implicitly causality. And only then are you able to grasp, while you're on the perceptual level, that issue that when you close your eyes, the world goes away. When you open them, it comes back, and you see the action of your senses. You see, I have this faculty of being aware or not, depending upon what I do. That's the implicit grasp of consciousness. That comes early after causality. So it's months into the process. But that is not yet volition. Volition doesn't manifest itself until the conceptual level. And even the very early rungs of the conceptual level are tantamount to being automatic. Once a child is looking, for instance, at a few tables in contrast to a chair, it's so elementary there, so straightforward, that if he doesn't have brain damage, it would take an incredible act of evasion to miss the similarity as against the difference, especially if his mother is there saying, table, table, table. So there's not much volition operative in the early levels, the early stages of the conceptual faculty. Volition in a serious way starts to be exercised when the conceptual level becomes more complex and difficult, when it doesn't just strike you over the head. And that is probably when you get enough concepts, now here I'm speculating, that they don't automatically separate themselves from one another, and a special act of focus is required to say, I'm talking about this, not that. Or particularly when you get higher level integrations, when you get to furniture rather than table. And also when you get to concepts of consciousness, where you need a special inward turning. Now, it's on that types of complexity that volition first clearly manifests itself. And that is probably, I don't know, what age do kids start to speak rather fluently, where they can utter sentences? Is it 18 months, something like that? Who's a mother or a teacher here? Is that right? At what age do they start saying, a stitch in time saves nine, I want dinner, I want to watch TV, and so on? Somewhere between 18 months and 2 years, I guess. That is approximately the period when volition starts to be operative. And therefore, the child couldn't become aware of volition until that stage. So he becomes aware of volition maybe a year and a half or 2 years, a year and a half or more after he becomes aware of consciousness. Now, you go on to say, the questioner says, I know the axioms are true by sense perception. You've said that. Does this include the axioms of consciousness and volition? Well, without the word sense, consciousness and volition at the appropriate points are grasped by direct perception. But you wouldn't say sense perception, because they are not external to you. They are you. Therefore, you don't need data fed to physical instrumentality like your fingertips or your tongue or whatever, and messages going along to the brain to reach you. It's already there. So I wouldn't say sense perception any more than you need sense perception to experience a toothache. You don't have to rub your tongue against your tooth to feel the toothache. You can let your tongue, you know, keep it away, don't touch it, don't blow on it, just sit there and you feel the ache pulsing. And it doesn't take much of an act of introspection to bring it out in its full horrible reality. Now we learn consciousness, and similarly it is simply presented to us by the fact that we are conscious and we have the ability to grasp that we're conscious. If you're animals, you can't introspect. So they're conscious, but their consciousness doesn't contain the potential of self-consciousness. But human beings, it does, and they simply have to get to the point where that focus is pointed out to them, is brought to their attention. No other faculty is required but the brain. So then the questioner goes on, is introspection then a special form of perception? Yes. I would say it is. It's inner perception. That's that question. Yes.
Doctor, during the primary choice, I can grasp the choice to focus, and I can grasp the choice to convey, and I can grasp that there is a state of being in drift. What I can't grasp is how the choice to evade and the choice not to focus differ.
I've covered that. Let me go right to that paragraph, because I put it as best I could on page 90. That is the best formulation I can give. Evasion and out of focus differ in many regards, even though they have both in common the fact that they are not focusing. One is completely passive, the out of focus state. You just let it go. In that state, you have no goal, no purpose motivating. There is nothing your consciousness is after. Now, the best way to think of that as an example is, you're tired at the end of the day, you're watching TV, say, and you don't care about the program. It's completely meaningless to you. You don't care whether you listen to it or not. Your mind is simply drifting. And maybe a fragment of the TV will come to you, but a minute later you couldn't say what it was. If somebody stopped you in 1 minute and said, what was this show about? I don't know, there was a boat, I think, a flag. Somebody said, I'm leaving. It's all just chaos. You just get little fragments. And interspersed as you think of what your boss said, or what was said in the lecture, or what you're going to have for dinner, just random stray thoughts. You're not doing anything. Your reins are completely idle, you see. You're not working at all. It's the exact opposite of working. There's no energy expenditure. There's no attempt to do anything, and that it covers all of your mental content. You just let it wash over you. That is simply out of focus, neutral, idle. Now, evasion is a very different thing. In evasion, you are electrified by a purpose. You have a very definite goal, and you're pouring energy in. You're working. You're not just sitting back. And the best way to think of evasion is, some horrible thing that you don't want to be true. You're afraid of it. That's why I say evasion is motivated. Evasion, there's always something you don't want to know, and you just decide it's too horrible to face. The classic standard example is you see your wife leaving on an appointment. She says she's going to be out for several hours, and the thought comes to your mind, how come she goes out, every night? She never says where she is. And you have a real suspicion. The words almost start to form. You can feel them about to form. Maybe she has a lover. But as they're just beginning to well up, you slam the brakes on. You close the mental screen. You simply deflect your mind with a ferocious act of will. Perhaps you rush to pick up the phone to talk to a friend about business, or, whatever, just to wrench your mind away from it. Now, that is evasion. I mean, I'm blowing it up to make a cosmic thing, but that is not at all the same state as simply drift. In drift, if the thought of your wife comes to you, comes and goes, just whatever comes. But in evasion, there's a threat. And you're taking action, you're mobilizing your resources not to see this threat. Do you see that? And therefore, the best formulation I've put is on 90. In one, he doesn't work to see. In the other, he works not to see.
I can see the three states.
There.
How to enter that state of threat?
There is no how. You just let go. That's what's given you by nature. The drift is simply given you. If you don't exercise will, that's what's the state of default. That's like asking, how does a car get stopped? That's what it is until you turn the key on. You see? You don't do anything once, you know, when you just have a car, it just sits there forever. If you don't will to start the mental process, it just idles. It just goes in drift. So in that sense, it's the opposite of will. It's the choice, simply let it be. That's what the choice not to focus is. Let it go. Relax the reins. Yes, right.
That's the primary choice.
We're on the primary one, yeah.
That's the primary choice. Focus is necessitated by your nature.
That's right. Is necessitated by what?
By the nature, by being a human.
Right, yeah.
And since you do it without any content of your consciousness, is it the case that you can't judge an individual as to what choice he makes, either effort orientation or the non-effort?
Certainly not. That doesn't follow at all. Can you judge an individual for choosing to be out of focus if that is a primary choice? There's nothing whatever about it being a primary choice that makes it unjudgeable. On the contrary, if there weren't a primary choice, that would mean there would be ultimately no choice. Everything would be determined by another and another and another and another, and then that would be determinism, and you couldn't judge. There's no reason why a primary choice is incompatible with judgment, because a primary choice is a choice. Absolutely, that's the nature of your consciousness. You have to start it, but you are entirely responsible for any choice you make. Now remember this, you do not need objectivism or Ayn Rand to grasp that existence depends upon awareness. It is not as though the whole human race was asleep and couldn't figure out what is the point of being aware. You know, that is not a higher level discovery. The child from the beginning knows that he can't cross the street without opening his eyes. They don't say, I don't see any reason to open my eyes before I cross the street. That's a self-evidency, a literal self-evidency, that action requires awareness, that life requires awareness. That's evident to any being. So that's not the, however, the same as a motive, you see. That is a kind of like a metaphysical principle that is implicitly graspable by any conscious being, an animal. In its own terms, would never dream, although it doesn't know any concepts, you know, or any motives, to sit there with its eyes closed in the midst of a forest. And it would just be automatic that it has to be aware, because otherwise danger is everywhere. Now that knowledge is given to anybody, and because otherwise you're implying this kind of situation. You're saying before the person goes in focus, he has no clue as to why he should go and focus, so why should he? That is completely untrue. If he's if he's a few months old, he knows as much about why you should be in focus. If I asked you right now, why should you be in focus, right? What's the point of being in focus? What? I mean, you could either say, there's the precondition of everything, that's the answer. And that means everything requires that. Now that is not, that maybe you need objectivism to state that and define it, but that implicit knowledge is available to anybody. And if they don't activate that awareness, then they are certainly morally to be judged. Absolutely. No.
One person might be passively drifting, knowing that it's okay under these circumstances. And another person could be passively drifting without knowing or caring whether it's okay. Is there a difference? Is focus an issue between those two people? Is there a difference that can be attributed to in terms of focus?
You want, can't ask another one before I answer that, no. No matter how it's connected, I'm going to lose what he said by the crow epistemology. Professor Buechner is saying, one person may be out of focus and know it, and do it deliberately, in effect. And another, tell me if I'm paraphrasing you wrong.
Had a hard day and
right.
Really
he's doing it as
paying attention to the TV.
Right.
But you know that's okay.
Yes. And another person may be out of focus in the sense that he's taking action and so on, and he's not paying attention. Are both of those the same state of being out of focus? They're both the same state psychologically, but they're not the same state morally. That is, if you're not in focus, you're not in focus, whatever your reasons or the rest of your psychology. Focus doesn't make any difference. You're either in it or you're not. Of course, there's degrees that we're assuming, a complete relaxation. And in that sense, there's no differences between types of out-of-focusness. But there's a tremendous moral difference in the two cases you cite. The moral choice according to objectivism, the moral evil, you haven't got chapter 6-7, I'm sorry. But I'm very careful to say that the evil according to objectivism is not being out of focus. The evil is what? Evasion. The deliberate refusal to conform to reality, the attempt to put the I wish above the it is. Out of focus as such is evil only when it's a product of evasion. And the evil is then the evasion, not the sheer being out of focus. So if you come home and you're really tired, and you say, I couldn't do another drop of mental work, I'm just going to turn the motor off and let it idle. And then you have before the TV exactly what I described in an earlier question. A stray fragment from here, and a word from there, and an image from there. And for practical purposes, you're sleep sitting. You're awake, but you're just in a drift. If you do that for a reasonable amount of time, that is not 23 hours a day, because then you have to evade the requirements of life. But if you do that as a rest when you're tired, and secondly, if you do it when you make no decisions that carry further. In other words, in that state, you can reach for a glass if you've got enough remnant of focus not to pour it over yourself. You can bring it to your lips and drink it, but you cannot come to conclusions, make decisions, take actions, make plans, talk on the phone, etc. Plan out your schedule. In other words, if you willfully say, look, I'm tuning out, I'm off duty, so to speak, and I'm not doing anything that has any further consequences, then why not? Certainly. I've spent whole days like that when I'm sick. It's very boring. After a certain period of time, you just, even to just do a crossword puzzle or something, because you're really sick of just that bleary-eyed, vacant stare. But in and of itself, that is not immoral. When does it become immoral? It's still the same state of being out of focus, but it's when you do it characteristically, when that is your normal pattern. And focus is an occasional exception. You pick up the phone to order groceries, you come into focus, and the minute the phone call is over, the next 3 hours, you just wander around in a daze. Then you're simply giving up your life. You're simply throwing away your entire life. You are then evading the requirements of life, and of course you're institutionalizing the kind of habits that are going to cripple your mind and gradually make it harder and harder ever to focus. So it's a big difference whether it's a peripheral, temporary issue of tiredness or illness, or it's your normal behavior. and also what you do in that state. If you take action, come to conclusions while out of focus, that is immoral, and that presupposes evasion. You just can see that on the simplest level. If you decide to cross the street out of focus, you know perfectly well, or you could know, that you should be in focus to cross the street. If you don't, you are evading the knowledge available to you. Now, the out-of-focus state is the same in both cases. I mean, there's not, you know, red and green out-of-focus. It's just one state. But it's all the difference in the world morally, you know, what these other factors. Does that answer your question? You said I was surprised. You didn't hear. He said in a sort of surprised way, gee, I really learned something from that. So I'm glad, but did you want to say anything further? Okay. I was still on the primary one.
In Atlas Shrugged, the character of Cheryl Taggart, when she's being courted by James Taggart,
yes.
Is she habitually out of focus?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I can hear Ayn Rand saying that from the grave. What? Cheryl Taggart is supposed to be like Eddie Willers. She's supposed to symbolize the good average person. She's not a superior intellect or a genius, but she's supposed to be a completely moral, honest person, struggling to grasp the incomprehensible evil around her. She is the exact opposite of being out of focus. Everything that Taggart does, she tries to analyze, to explain. She's a living demonstration of somebody struggling, working to understand what's around her. Now, she is, if anybody ever was, committed to full awareness. She, what his friends say in the art shows they go to and the way they behave and all the signs of his uselessness and so on, she puts it all together and she continuously confronts him. That's what he can't stand. So, heaven forbid that you would think that Cheryl Taggart is out of focus. Jim Taggart is the one that is out of focus as a chronic way of life, and he just oscillates between drift and evasion, with periodic moments of coming to and being in focus enough to utter some evil sentences, and then he drifts, goes back. But that is completely not. What would make you think that Cheryl was out of focus? If you ask that, you must think that ignorance is related to out of focus, and it's completely not related. Not related.
I'm going to finish and ask if she was, or if she was in focus but making errors.
You must not confuse. There's nothing more urgent as far as this lecture or topic is concerned than to distinguish between your intelligence, your knowledge, the amount of truth you have on the one side, and the state of focus on the other. They are absolutely not related. You can have a brilliant mind, a power of genius, filled with knowledge, even with knowledge of objectivism, and he can be out of focus by will, whenever he wants, as much as he wants. And on the other hand, you can have someone completely ignorant, a child who knows nothing about philosophy, the world, thinking methods, nothing. And maybe even a dumb child. You know, I mean, assuming he's not, he still has a brain that's functional, he's not severely retarded, but he's not especially intelligent. And he can be 100% in focus. This has to do with, are you committed to using the mental resources you have to understand? It has absolutely nothing to do with how much do you understand, how many mistakes do you make, how much do you know, how smart are you. There's no correlation whatever. And if you miss this, you cannot relate focus to intelligence at all. Of course, if the more you focus, the more you will get the full power of your intelligence, you will look more intelligent to yourself and others than if you habitually drift or evade, and you'll just atrophy your mind, and you won't even have the power that you actually potentially have, and you'll end up looking stupid. But focus is an entirely separate factor from intelligence or knowledge. I dread to think the confusion that we hadn't discussed that. So does anybody have any doubts on that one point? Because that is life and death, otherwise you lose the whole subject. Yes, at the back. Louder.
On that principle, when you focus your mind, doesn't that exercise your mind? And you could increase your intelligence by actually exercising.
Yes, and you're saying what I just said. I do think that intelligence, at least operative intelligence, can be increased by the proper use of your mind. Now, this is psychology, not philosophy, so I can't claim this as scientific proof. But from my observation, I feel that my mind works better now than it did 20 years ago. I actually feel more intelligent than I did 20 years ago, in the sense of what I can encompass and what I can do with my mind. And I think that a lot of people have had that experience. And I've certainly, on the other hand, seen the other direction. People are pretty bright as teenagers, and they become simply sluggish and inert, passive, and they can't get anything by the time they're in their 40s or 50s. So I do think that the more you exercise it, the more your capacity is. That still, however, leaves open the question, is there an upper limit to your potential given by the nature of your brain? So that even if you're a demon of focus, you know, you can only hit so much, and that's what your mechanism is. I don't purport to have a view on that question. Is that John? The back. No, can't see that. Yeah, Andy, yeah.
Is consciousness alertness on a
continuum? Can't hear you.
Is consciousness alertness on a continuum?
Continuum, yes.
So that if I make a choice, the first focus, it comes from a state of semi-focus or already being unconsciously active.
Correct. Let me say a word on that. That's a good point. Conscious alertness or consciousness as such exists on a continuum. And in fact, I say that on 83, there are degrees of awareness. It is not that you're either aware or you're out, because then there could be no such thing as the choice to focus. And I, you know, this is a rationalistic type question asked all the time. If there were only you're aware or you're asleep, and that was the only two choices, then while you were sleeping, you obviously couldn't choose to focus, because you don't know anything, you're unconscious. If the next instant you're conscious, then where did the choice come from? Now, this is a typical, it comes from not looking at reality. There are all degrees, I wouldn't say infinite, but many, many degrees. That's why we don't just say being in focus, but being in full focus. That's why I said what did I mean by full awareness? All the facts, as clearly as you can, by all the processes available to you. Now, there's a big difference between one fact and 50 facts, and there's 49 stages in between. Between crystal clarity and utter blurriness, which is still something, you just imagine a lens getting gradually clearer and clearer and clearer. Between using one mental process for 1 minute or using 10 of them for 20. In other words, if you keep in mind what is meant by full focus and what is meant by complete out of focus, the absolute drift, there are many stages in between. It is not an either or. When you are out of focus, you are still aware. You are aware enough to know the state you're in, and if you're taking action, to know that focus is required. That is not something you have to choose to learn. That is given to you. The state of your consciousness is transparent to you. You may not know the word focus and so on, but whether you're alert and functioning or not, you know, without having to defocus your attention on that fact. Otherwise, you'd have an infinite regress. Yes?
All
right, you want me to answer that one?
Please.
He said, I said to myself, I have to be in full focus in order to learn philosophy today. Isn't my being in focus then motivated? No. You had to be in focus to make that resolution. You had to be in focus, first of all, to guide your steps here. Certainly if you're as disoriented spatially as I am, or you end up at the golf house, But beyond that, to have such a complex thought as, I have a cognitive goal, and that's going to require something of me, and this is what I'm going to do, is already takes for granted being in focus. You have misidentified what your goal was, and it's okay as long as you really know what you mean. What you mean is, I'm going to give my all to this subject this morning. I'm going to not let my focus lapse, and I'm not also going to direct it to anything else. Those are the two meanings when you say, I'm going to be in full focus. What you're really saying is, when I get there, I'm making a resolution. I'm going to continuously reaffirm that choice. And secondly, I'm going to keep it directed at the front end of what he's saying. In other words, if a neighbor whispers to me or I catch some notes or something, I'm going to not look at it. Now, that second part of it is, of course, motivated. We can say, well, why is Andy so interested in philosophy? There's a lot of people in this hotel wouldn't make that particular choice. And that's a higher level choice. What you focus on is motivated. But the choice to focus on A versus B presupposes, first of all, the being in focus. Does that answer it? Good. What? Oh, thank you. Oh, you want to take a break? Well, since my voice is... Do you want a break? Oh. All right, we'll take a 5-minute break. Now, somebody during the intermission gave me an analogy about the three mental states, and I don't think it adds anything philosophically, but I certainly don't think it's harmful. And he said that he found that his group of objectivists found this helpful, so I'll read it without comment. Maybe it'll do something for somebody. He said I could use it free of charge, but he didn't give me his name, so it's not mine. I'm just reading it. He calls it the mental voltmeter metaphor. Imagine a needle display meter, like you used to see on stereo amplifiers. Vertical position indicates drifting. Positive position indicates focus. Negative position indicates evasion. The key element is a little spring that constantly tries to pull a needle back to the vertical position if it should ever deviate left or right. So to maintain the needle in a position other than neutral, which is drifting, you have to apply a voltage, either positive into focus or negative into evasion. And the crucial point is that focus is not automatic, it requires effort, and if ever you release that effort, you swiftly return to unfocused drifting. Do you find that helpful? Well, good, I'll steal that then. But that is not original with me, but it does give you certain features that are definitely good parallels, so thank you, whoever gave me that. Now I want to turn to the section on human actions as both caused and free. Although somebody had a question about full awareness involving awareness of consciousness. Where is that? Is that you? Go ahead, ask that now. I told him to ask it after the break.
Does the meaning of full context mean being aware of what you see and what is going on in your mind, both at the same time?
Yes and no. That's a clear-cut answer. Does full consciousness of reality involve extrospection and awareness of consciousness at the same time? In a sense, the answer is yes. In that, every focused state of awareness has a self-conscious element. When you choose consciousness, you are taking over the reins. You are being aware deliberately. And when you do that, you know that you are. Therefore, implicit in your awareness is the state of your consciousness. So in that sense, only a drifter is utterly oblivious to his consciousness. Only when you simply turn away and say, I'm not doing anything with it, let it go. Then you don't have any clue what state it's in. If you're in focus, you are implicitly aware that you are. But here comes the no. That does not mean that thinking is introspection. Thinking about reality is extrospective. introspection in the sense of turning deliberately in as a cognitive task and studying what your mind is doing is not involved in the process of full focus. In other words, your awareness of your consciousness is only implicit, only that awareness which is unavoidable given that you are purposefully setting the terms. But what you're doing with your mind is using it to gain external knowledge. And in that sense, you are not introspective or, quote, aware of your consciousness. You're aware of reality. If you get that distinction, that, I think, would be helpful to clarify. All right, now on, let's go to some questions on causality. The second sequence? Yes.
I'd like to go back to the example of the raising of the arm.
Yeah.
Right, just see if I understand it. Suppose I raised my arm, like I just did, to be called on. I had to be in full focus.
If it's a deliberate choice.
Right.
You can raise your arm without it being a choice if that's something you've automatized.
Okay.
Under certain contexts, you know, you may have throw up your hands in horror, you know, after a while that is automatic to you. So if I come up and say, boo, your hand will go up in the air, that was not a choice. But suppose you're just sitting there calmly, and there's no such situation.
Yeah. You asked a question, so right. I raised my arm.
Yeah, then you decide to raise it. Yeah.
Now, I had to be in full focus in order for the reason raising, I want to ask a question, so I should raise my arm. In order for that reason.
No,
I
would question that, but go ahead, yeah.
Okay, well, I was just trying to go through the steps that you went through in explaining. Yeah.
You have to be in focus to raise your arm deliberately. When you say full focus, you make me slightly edgy there because...
Just in focus.
What?
Just in focus.
Okay, because you see, we're talking about a very elementary action here. And full focus is what's required to write on philosophy. So I do not think you could make the case that to raise your arm, full focus is necessary. You could, I'm sure... If you have a modest intelligence, you could get along on less than the total resources of your consciousness. But you can't be entirely out of focus, or you won't be able to assume the discipline of a purpose.
But if you do something, if you make a higher level choice for a reason,
yes,
that is not just out of drift, then you needed to be in focus in order for that reason
to be operative. Yes. Right.
Now, as I understood your explanation before, you said it's not just that you need to be in focus and thus to be able to have the reason in mind and select the reason, because once you're in that state, your actions don't follow automatically. There's still a further choice element.
Right.
And as I understood it, that choice element you described as then making the reason operative in action.
That's right. Committing to it. Saying, I've looked enough, this is it, I'm taking this path.
Now yeah. That little bit, that is itself then something irreducibly volitional.
Every choice, if I get the drift of where you're going. Every choice is irreducible in the sense that it's a choice. And you're making a very good point. A choice by its nature is a self-caused, you're the prime mover of it. Because if there weren't an element that it's simply you did it, if you could take it back and say it was inevitable as a result of this constellation of inner or outer factors, it wouldn't be a choice. So there is, let me just elaborate this now, because I think I get your drift. There is a sense in which every choice is irreducible, meaning by that, it is a choice and you can't take it completely back to anything earlier. You can't even take it entirely back to being in focus because given that you're in focus, you still had to decide, now that I'm in focus and now that I see this factor, I'm going to execute it and take this direction. In that basic sense, all choices are irreducible, but there is, that doesn't change the crucial difference. The crucial difference is that all these higher level choices, the sheer choice is not enough. It's like a combination of factors. It has to be the choice committing to certain aspects of reality, or if you're out of focus, evading or slumping those off. The primary choice, though, is just the choice element without, in addition, the factors that you have to focus on to generate. So there is a crucial difference, And there's a crucial time sequence. The focus has to precede to make possible all these other choices. But you're right, if you try to break it down in terms of split seconds, inherent in a choice is that you choose it. It comes from within you, and you cannot entirely break it, take it back to focus. This was the reason I said it controls. Focus controls, but does not necessitate. Otherwise, you'll be back to the zombie model. All you do is come to and walk around, and reality thereafter dictates your behavior. Anything more on this? I'm trying to get... I know you're on the honor system. Yes. Yeah, you.
Okay. I actually have two short questions. I'd appreciate permission to ask them both.
Well, take one and let's see how we do with that first. Yeah.
Okay. This is what this is how you opened up. It's regarding the actions without goals.
The what?
Actions without goals. You said
Isn't
the goal of the child riding the bike the child's pursuit of happiness via leisure activities?
Yeah.
And wasn't the goal of your daughter hanging upside down to impress
right.
her daddy?
Say that again.
I said, isn't the goal of the child riding the bike the child's pursuit of happiness via leisure activities?
Well, you are saying that, but that is not the way it stands in the mind of the child. The pursuit of happiness through leisure is not a motive that gets you functioning. I want happiness. I like leisure. I always want happiness, and a lot of the time I like leisure. That does not get me to stand up and do something. In order to translate a tremendous abstractions like that into the motivation that you can say explains the action, you know, in a serious or scientific way, you have to say what kind of leisure, why, what do you like doing. You have to break it down very specifically. Now, a child on the type of consciousness that we're talking about, certainly she doesn't just get up on the jungle gym quote for no reason, but I was trying to point out there she had no purpose beyond the activity. It's not as though this activity is motivated, let us say, to build up my muscles. When I have my muscles really built up, I can enter into competition. If I do really well in competition, then I'll be able to join the Olympics. If I can get into the Olympics, I can go to Australia when they have the meeting there, and there I know that my hero, boyfriend I've always loved, is waiting for me in Australia. And that's my end in itself. Now she says, that's why I'm hanging on the parallel bars. Now that is the paradigm of motivated behavior that I was talking from.
She had no other motive outside the activity itself. Why would she have said, hey daddy, look?
She said, hey daddy, look, because she was just enjoyed the exercise of her capacity and she wanted to show it to me. So certainly she said it because I was there and she wanted approval. And presumably she wanted approval for various reasons. But that, the hey daddy is not relevant because she would do it whether, you know, somebody was there to approve or not. Now, you're trying to get me into this situation. You're saying action requires motive. Yes, it does. And she couldn't take this type of action unless she had a lot of knowledge, unless, you know, she had time, unless she had certain skills. All of that is certainly true. So that is, if you're mistaking the analogy, if you take that as an example of a primary choice. I was taking it from one selected aspect simply to show you that you cannot take a rationalistic rule out of context, that there's always some distant future goal that a person is after. And then I said, now let's apply it, let's apply it to the real primary case. It's like this, only it's much more unmotivated because the whole question of motives couldn't even come up on the primary case. So if you found that analogy confusing, because after all physical actions are motivated, ignore it. I found it helpful, I saw some people find it helpful, but nothing is an analogy to the primary choice. Why is that true? Why can't I find any better analogy to a primary choice? Because it's the only one. A primary choice is unique. A choice per se is unique, and a primary choice is unique in spades. There's absolutely nothing like it in the universe. So, you know, all we can do, since it's a primary and is accessible to you directly by introspection, is struggle to give analogies, to say, well, in this one respect where you're confused, you could think of it as being like this. But then, of course, if you press the analogy and say, yeah, but you have to wear shoes when you're on the jungle gym and you don't when you focus, so it doesn't say true. The analogy doesn't hold, you know? I mean, you can only go so far with an analogy. Was that just the first? Okay. All right.
Okay. Well, the second one involves the other analogy. You spoke of an animal with omnipotent powers that, and therefore we could predict.
Infallible.
The animal that we could, you know, predict every.
Omnipotent and infallible are not the same. Yeah.
Well, remember you were speaking of the animal that would be completely predictable because it was had these certain powers earlier today.
I can't say I remember that, but ask the question anyway.
Well, I thought I heard you say something about if we could imagine this animal that...
All animals are infallible. That is not just a construct. I mean, they can go wrong because they can go very far, but as far as they go, they're right. They don't come to false conclusions because they don't come to conclusions. Now, you can say, I know I'm going to get this question, can't a dog, quote, think that this was his food, and then he takes a mouthful, he howls because it wasn't, you know, it tasted wrong, etc. So if you look at it from that point of view, you could say he had an anticipation that was frustrating. But in the strict sense, the dog did not in advance say, my hypothesis is that this is my food, and I'm going to go and verify this, oh gee, I was wrong. In that sense, they just perceive and react. They don't have conclusions, and their percepts, as far as they go, are infallible. So that's why we have no grounds to ascribe volition to animals. Because the validation of volition, the establishment of it as being objective, is that it's a requirement of a conceptual consciousness. Now this... What?
Getting animals to tell the truth.
Well, then ask your question without reference
to it. If we can imagine an omnipotent being for the time being.
Okay.
If an omnipotent being had no volition and therefore was completely predictable, how could you call the being omnipotent? All powerful includes
that. That does not relate. You should be asking that of the Pope, not of me. If I imagine an omnipotent being without volition, how could I call him omnipotent if he has no choice? I don't believe in an omnipotent being. An omnipotent being, as I've already covered in chapter 1, is a violation of the law of identity. A being who can do anything or make entities do anything is a being who can make things act contrary to their natures, can violate the law of identity. And consequently, the thing is out from the beginning. In objectivism, you wouldn't even entertain such a notion. And in fact, I said in chapter 1 that it's either omnipotence or the law of identity. So there's no use entering into all the theological puzzles about does omnipotence include volition or exclude it? Does it include the power to commit evil or exclude it? You're going to be in a lot worse trouble than those puzzles if you accept omnipotence. So you misheard me, and what you're saying has nothing to do with objectivism. I want to drop that altogether. Put God with the photons. Although I gather the photons are real. Yeah. Yes.
I'm thinking of the boat meter. Of choice, and I'm wondering if you put Chewy on one end of the
voltmeter,
the negative end, because that's the trouble of the analogy. And Dagny on the positive end. To what extent does evasion or the choice to focus ever become habitual?
To what extent does the choice to focus or go out of focus or evade become habitual? It's very dangerous to discuss that loosely. I tried to cover that. Where is the... What page is that? I have a paragraph specifically to cover... 88. You know my script better than me. Yes, correct. That paragraph on the bottom of 88 was written in answer to that question. The fact that these things, the choice to focus or not, is primary, does not mean that your lifetime ideas and policies are irrelevant to your state or inclinations. I don't know how to say it better than I said it here. If you are characteristically in focus and your ideas are basically reasonable, you will grow in knowledge, you will feel more confident, and it will be easier to be in focus. Now, that doesn't mean it will be automatic. It'll be more natural and less of a strain. And the best way you can think of this is this. You have to come to, by that basic act of will, no matter what the circumstances, no matter what your mental content or lifetime practices, you still have to do it. But there's a difference in how hard it is, even if you're a rational person, according to the particular content you're working with. Now, for instance, if I'm learning this material, I know this material, I have it basically automatized in my subconscious from decades of doing nothing but answering these questions and writing on this subject. So as soon as you say to me, what about X? It's like, a switch goes on and you just feed the computer. If I just go to sleep, I just drift, it won't come out. But as long as I put a certain minimal energy in, the mouth more or less gives the answer. You see, I have to will, but it's easy. On the other hand, I'll take an example, sitting at the desk alone with a blank sheet of paper, starting the subject of volition, let us say. When you don't know it all, and there's 30 confusions surrounding every word. Now, I take that as the analogy, because that can happen to anybody, however rational. Take that as the analogy to the total mental state of a person who's characteristically out of focus and irrational. Now, in that state, as I know myself, when you sit down and say the equivalent of, okay, plunge in, focus, it's really hell on wheels. There's a tremendous resistance. You have to keep pulling yourself back to it. You get two steps, and the process stops, dissolves in fog, and you say, no, I've got 12 different ways I could go, and you can't even hold in mind the ways. And there's a continuous, it's like sand in the gears, where you have to push, and then a little patch will break through, and maybe there's 3 minutes, where all you have to do is focus painlessly, and then you get stuck again. Now, in that sense, depending upon the material, the process can be much harder or much easier. And you can experience that within certain limits, yourself. But you just have to project the effects on a total individual's life. If he's characteristically out of focus, everything to him must be as chaotic and difficult and agonizing as, to me, creative writing. And I can't think of a worse penalty that God could ever have given to vice than that state of the agony of coming to be in focus. However, while it's true, therefore, that your patterns can make it easier or harder, they don't make it automatic or inevitable. No matter how easy it is, you don't have to do it. And no matter how hard it is, you can do it. Because what it comes down to, really, is it's on or it's off. The rest is the use of it. And that you have, and nobody will do that for you. That basic on or off can't be easier or harder. But it's experienced as harder because you don't just turn it on, you turn it on to a task, you see. It's in that sense that it can be harder. Are these clarifications clarifying or confusing you? Good, because there's a certain point at which there's so many distinctions and clarifications and analogies that don't entirely hold that the crow could set in. Yes. Yeah.
On page
95.
Causality.
Yeah.
And in get some hint of those clarifications earlier, because I felt an incompleteness with respect to the way the law of causality was covered in the first section, and it was very much confused.
Are you found this helpful? Well, basically, you want to reorganize the book, and the reason that the questioner is saying there's a paragraph on causality on 95 and another paragraph on the top of 102 that made the principle of causality much clearer, and why didn't it put those in the basic discussion of causality in chapter 1? My answer to that would be this is a specialized application of causality. This is the application of causality to consciousness and the indication of the various types of causality. That is not really appropriate to metaphysics. Metaphysics can only deal with that which is true of everything. When it deals with causality, therefore, it can only apply in the most abstract sense. Any entity, mental, physical, meta-energy, you name it, if it has a nature, it has to act a certain way. Then when you come to study specialized entities, it becomes only at that point appropriate to say, given this type of entity, the principle of causality would apply in this way. And that's deliberate, therefore, and this is by no means the only thing of this kind. If you went into the philosophy of science, you would find a great many things about scientific law, necessary and sufficient condition and all the types of causes and how we discover them and remote and proximate causes and can there be more plurality of causes? Can there be more than one cause of the same effect? There's 100 interesting to philosophers of science questions about causality, which are often illuminating when you get the right answers to them. But that doesn't mean that when you state causality in metaphysics, you should go into 200 pages of everything you could say to clarify causality. It's really the issue of the spiral theory of knowledge. We lay the foundation, and then we build on there. And that's why I did it this way. But you see, if you find that something in chapter 2 or 3 clarifies something in chapter 1, there's two possibilities. One is, I didn't arrange the book correctly. I should have stuck that in at the beginning. The second is the spiral theory of knowledge. You build on what you knew earlier, because you will find continuously that later material makes earlier material clearer by the higher integrations you're able to make. But you have to get the earlier material before the later. Yes?
Do animals have any kind of choice at all? Or do they, if not, can you apply a deterministic, mechanistic argument to animals that they're just like stones rolling down a hill? And if they do have any kind of choice, does that conceptual choice have any relationship with our primary?
I don't know. It's a simple answer to your question. Study of animals is outside the province of philosophy. It would have to be done by some combination of biologists and psychologists, and I don't even know by what mechanism they would do it. And the question is, can animals have any form of volition, and if so, of what kind? I simply have no means of knowing. I can't introspect an animal consciousness. And by the nature of what you're talking about, I can't extrospect it. I can see their behavior, but I can't get the feel of what their consciousness is like. And if they have a choice, I don't know what it would be, how they would experience it, what it would consist of in their terms. Ayn Rand used to say that you can know, in principle, all of existence, but you can't necessarily know the way existence is experienced by another type of consciousness. Now, if it's human, you assume it's the same as yours. But the way an animal relates to reality, and in what sense, if at all, it directs the mechanism, is something I simply wouldn't even know in theory how to do. All I could say from the outside is, it looks like certain animals do something rudimentary, analogous to choice. Like if you see a cat looking at the dish of milk. You see, the eyes go to it, and go away. Go back, go away. Look at it, and then, decisively, stand up and go. Now it certainly looks like It's weighing or considering yes, no, yes, no, yes. And that, of course, is the paradigm of choice, this oscillation between alternatives and then commitment. So it looks like it, but you know it's very dangerous to be anthropomorphic and ascribe human behavior to in the absence of a conceptual faculty. So I just have to say I do not know. It's outside my field, at the back. No, the one that plaid, sure.
I'd like to say in connection with that that I have found it extremely useful to continue concentrating on the fact that man is the rational animal. And as such, I have no problem whatsoever recognizing, for example, that lower animals do exhibit attributes such as attention, yeah, which they can internally vary within limits to a degree, which is in many ways analogous to this.
It's definitely analogous. He's saying animals can vary their attention. That's certainly true. But what's open is that attention's direction of the attention entirely controlled by the external stimuli? Or does some element originate within? Now that I don't know. And there's no use even discussing it because it has no deeper philosophic significance. And our time is going here. I wanted to make, I had a couple last, I think, points here. Oh, yeah, on page 99. This was applying the choices not to a thought process, but now to action. And this just might be a small integration that's helpful to you. That little paragraph, the second on page 99, in regard to action, a man's choice, one he must make continually in every issue, is to act in accordance with his values or not. Now, I think I made clear the way in which you can hold values and so on and still not act in accordance with them. But just to look ahead, in your case it'll be a long time, but when you would get to chapter 7 or 8, as a matter of fact, does this suggest to you the foundation, this particular formulation, of any specific virtue that objectivism advocates and acknowledges? Because this is actually the deepest philosophic base of one of the derivative virtues. All of the virtues rest on different kinds of metaphysical facts, and this particular type of choice is the one underlying which virtue? Which? Integrity, absolutely correct. I found that helpful because when you get to integrity, the essence of it is to act in accordance with your convictions or not. And if you focus on this here, it sets you up to grasp that man does have that choice. And that's a specialized application of the power of choice. And therefore, it's important to have a specific virtue covered. Now, I'll just throw it open to questions in general, but stay on the human level, that is neither animals nor God, in the back corner. Is that you, Rick? Yeah.
I have a question about axioms in general. As I was reading through, I listed the axiomatic concepts that I came across, the basic reaction plus entity, cause and effect, validity of the senses, and volition.
Now, wait a minute. Yeah? And you don't necessarily confuse axiom with basic axiom with axiomatic concept. Those aren't all the same thing. If you want an inventory of axiomatic concepts, I'm not able to do it. I just don't know. I've never attempted. What you would have to do is show that a certain concept is irreducible, that its content is accessible directly to perception without the need of any conceptual development in order to get it implicitly. And you'd have to be able to show that that information is all, you know, that you need and that everything else is based on that. To go through the totality of human concepts from the point of view of which ones fulfill that is a task I wouldn't even know how to begin. All I can do is say, certain concepts I know are axiomatic because this is what they say. There would be no way in logic of ever getting them from any place else, and no way you could get anything else without them. But I couldn't give you an inventory. Yeah, I know. The answer is I cannot say that the concepts I have mentioned exhaust the category of axiomatic concept. Nor would Ayn Rand have said that. Any more than, by the way, if I can make a big jump, she never held that her statement of virtues exhausts the field of virtue. She emphatically did not hold that there are seven and only seven virtues: rationality, independence, integrity, honesty, justice, productiveness, and pride. She said that she never attempted an exhaustive survey, and that that would require a whole separate methodology. You'd have to find some way to take the entire field of human action and say, you know, everything that's not A is non-A, and then within non-A, subdivide and so on, to show that there has to be seven and only. And she avowedly did not. She said, I am saying what I regard as essential within the knowledge of human action that I have. I know that these realms are crucial, how you relate to others, you know, how you, whether you work, that type of thing. But she wasn't interested in what Kant called architectonic. You know, in other words, a formalistic proof that there can only be 12 categories, 7 virtues, 9 axiomatic concepts, that was absolutely of no interest to her. You know, she was interested in just about any question you asked her, but if you asked anything of that schematic, rationalistic attempt to quantify out of context way, she would simply, her attention would drop, and she'd say, I don't know and I don't care. What I have to know from my knowledge is, are these concepts valid and are they axioms? Are these virtues valid and are they virtues? If somebody thinks they found another one on either row, good luck. If they can validate it, we'll all learn. If they can't, they made a mistake. But she didn't pretend to omniscience, you see, in either field, and she didn't know any methodology which could be tantamount to it. This is back to why she didn't work out any table of categories like Aristotle, you know, which is an attempt to give you the irreducible concept. She simply did not attempt what she thought was beyond validation. Does that clarify? Simply by the fact that we're not attempting that test. Okay, we have one final question. It can't be very long. Okay, right on the corner. Yeah.
Okay, on page 105, the first full paragraph, to explain what quality the principle of volition qua action has.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate on the distinction between the quality of primariness and the quality of mentality?
Yes, what is the difference between page 105? Between something being a primary and something being a fundamental? They're very closely related in this context, but the difference is only this. Primary has to do with the order of acquisition, the order of coming to learn something. And primary, obviously, is Latin for first. It's where you start. So it simply demarcates, if all the items here were arranged in a series, which would be number one? That's the primary. Which would be number two? Now, fundamental adds another idea. It says, the reason that two came after one is because two wouldn't stand without one. They're not independent elements. The second rests on the first. Something is fundamental when everything in a certain context depends on it. So fundamental injects the note of logical dependence. Do you get that? So they're really very closely related. The reason it's a primary is you can't get anywhere else except through it, because it's a fundamental. But since it's a fundamental, you have to do it first. So it's just a difference in focus. The order, and then how everything else requires that order, because they rest on it, you see. Now in other contexts, just to go into a linguistic clarification, you can talk about a fundamental which is not a primary. For instance, I could say, well, you're asking some really good questions, but the fundamental fact is our time is up. And therefore, that has to condition everything else, including the question. Now, that's not a primary. That isn't where we started that our time is up. It's where we ended. So the term primary would not be applicable, but the term fundamental would. But in this context, as applied to axioms, they're both, but it just simply points out to axioms actually have four attributes, if this is of any use to you. They're primary, they're fundamental, they are self-evident, and they're inescapable. That is to say, you can't attack them without using them. And of course, all of that really follows from the fact that that's where you start. And therefore, everything is built on it. You couldn't prove it by something else because that's where you start. It must be self-evident. And since that's where you start, nobody can get around it. They have to use it to even escape it, to try to attack it. So you could put it all into primary, but they simply point out different aspects. I'm sorry, our time is now really up. So you now know that you have choice. And on Saturday, we will start to form concepts using it. Thank you very much.